KQED.
KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Marissa Meyer is Vice President for Search Products and User Experience at Google. She joins us for a wide-ranging discussion about Google and its future, as well as how Google innovates, and we'll look at issues such as privacy with her and discuss to what extent Google upholds their Don't Do Evil credo. Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Wisconsin-born and Stanford-educated software engineer Marissa Meyer, who specialized at Stanford in artificial intelligence, became the 20th employee of Google in 1999 and rose to become global vice president in charge of search products and user experience. That means she essentially controls the direction of key products, including web, search, news, images, and maps, as well as the Google Earth, Google Toolbars, Google Desktop, and Google Labs. She has also taught computer science at Stanford and lectured on innovation, and every workday she spends a couple of hours in her office open to ideas that are either quickly deep-sixed, set aside, or put on a fast track. Her roles are integral in the operations of the giant search engine company, which presently has a workforce of thousands of employees working in 28 countries, and revenues expected this year to reach $3.7 billion. And Marissa Meyer joins us for the second forum hour. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. I'm very excited to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you here. And let's talk first about a statement you made that the science of search is still in its infancy. You said it's like biology or physics was in the 15th or 16th century.
I think that's right. I think that when you look at how complex information is and how far we still have yet to go in terms of search being as intelligent as, say, a person answering a question, we're really just at the dawn of understanding the signals inside of information, how to rate it, how to understand its relevance, and how to present it. I think that this will be a science that evolves over hundreds of years to become something that's much more comprehensive and detailed and really what you want.
And more personalized, which of course we'll have to talk about, but also more devices of search. I mean, you're talking about searching into wherever you are and using audio and using visual, using really everything that's now accessible.
Well, I think, you know, when a lot of people think about search, they think about the way it exists today on a PC with a search box where you type in keywords that have to appear on the page you're looking for. And, you know, I'm a search addict myself. I probably search as much as anyone possibly can, working at Google and thinking a lot about search. But I still probably do, in my estimation, only about 20% of the searches that come to me every day. Because a lot of the searches come to me when I'm not at a computer, or a lot of the searches aren't easy to express in keywords. So if you start thinking about how search could transition to mobile phones, to cars, to natural language, can you ask the computer a question in written form? Could you speak to the search engine? Those are all things that I think will evolve over time. And then there's also just the very basic level of concepts rather than keywords. Can you talk about an idea and have us understand pages that are about an idea rather than just the keywords on those pages?
This is moving onward and upward in the world of search, and it's exciting. People get a little nervous, though. In fact, Google's had some concerns. I think the street-wide features of Google on the map, a woman in a G-string, a man going into an adult bookstore. You can correct me if I don't have all these things right. A man relieving himself. I mean, these are the kinds of things that, well, get into concerns about personal side of making all this information accessible. And personalizing means also medical records, because that's certainly part of the future. Let's just talk about that issue, because it's a big one on people's minds, as you see it.
Sure. Well, for us at Google, privacy is very, very important, and we want to make sure that the intention of our products is really what comes through to our users. So interestingly, on Street View, it's really important to understand the intention. The idea there is that you can actually find physically what something looks like. So if you're meeting someone at a new restaurant, or you want to understand where the door to a museum is, you actually can see a picture. It's about finding locations, basically saving you time. It's not necessarily about seeing, it's not at all about seeing people on the street, particular faces, these types of things. And so that said, when we hear reports of those types of images appearing accidentally in our panoramas, we take them down. So if you see something like that...
But they can go out on the net nonetheless. I mean, they're out there after a fashion. In fact, when you were in Australia recently, I believe a lot of this came up and there was concern about it.
Yeah. Because we're actually driving Australia now to provide street view for the country. So we're
they're concerned about private roads and addresses and on faces and all that, aren't they?
Sure, and we are working on some technologies that help there. And certainly it is our policy not to proceed down private roads. That said, not all private roads are perfectly marked, and occasionally we'll have a driver miss a sign. But that said, again, we do have a good reporting and flagging policy where you can let us know that a panorama isn't appropriate because there's a face on it or because it's from a private road, and we'll take it down.
So when you say you're concerned about privacy, you're trying to be as prophylactic as you can be, up to whatever extent that can work.
That's right. And I think it's also really important to recognize that on these matters of privacy, it's often a trade-off. And our goal is really to get very high utility functionality to the user.
And is it David Weiss who writes in his book, The Google Story, about Google's secret plans to let us Google our own genes?
David did write a book called The Google Story. I haven't heard about the searching our own genes part.
But this has become an issue. I mean, it's resulted in some litigation, and I guess we can't talk about that, obviously. But what can be done to ensure listeners that there is really great concern about privacy and that you're taking the necessary precautions that you need to take?
Well, as I said, we do have the policies and the tools that when people find something that they feel violates their privacy, we can take it down on Street View. And for example, on other things like personalized search, where your web searches and your web search clicks are collected, we actually have a link on our results page where you can go and see your web history. So you can see all the information that Google has about your activities and actually what data we're using to personalize your search. So we think that the principles of transparency and control are very important in privacy. What does Google know? How is it used? And can a person have control over that?
I believe, if I have it correct, your mantra, or one of your mantras at least at any rate, is launch products early and often.
That's right. We think it's really important to get products out the door very early so we get user feedback and ultimately iterate to a product that fills the market need.
And you're there in your office a couple hours. I understand you at one time considered becoming an academic. You would have been maybe a Carnegie Mellon teaching. You would have had maybe not as many office hours a week as you do now because you're there 2 hours every day. People come in, and part of the innovation idea and what you stand for as far as innovation is getting these ideas from just wherever they may be in the atmosphere.
That's right. Ideas at Google come from everywhere. Some of them are top-down, some of them are bottoms-up. And office hours are really about people being able to bring in a prototype or bring in an idea, get some quick feedback. And the most important thing that I do in office hours is actually connecting people through the organization to say, oh, you know, here's another person who's interested in this problem. Here's someone else who's working on something similar. Hey, we could take this piece of functionality, we could put it into the toolbar, and really trying to make those connections happen so a lot of these features can be born into Google products.
Everything comes from within Google, or do you get ideas from
We definitely get ideas from the outside. In fact, some of our best ideas that come from user feedback.
And the user feedback comes to you how? I mean, are there people out there who would love to probably give ideas, and they'll have an opportunity when we open up our phone lines to talk to you directly. But if people want to, say, throw an idea to you, how do they do it?
So that we have lots of email addresses where they can reach Google. So, for example, there's business development, if you have a business idea. For users, if they're using the product and they have an observation, I really wish the toolbar would do this, or I really wish Google News would do that. There are email aliases for each of those products, and we have a user support team that goes and gathers those feature requests each week and lets us know what they are, and we try and build as many of them as we can into the products.
You've got such a powerful brand name. It's probably one of the top brand names in the world now. Brand name value, in fact, was estimated at $86 billion. And there are those who, in fact, when we did our program about the attempt of Microsoft to take over Yahoo, I was surprised at some of the feedback. It almost sounded like Google had become the new Microsoft. There was a sense that Google is too powerful. And once I mentioned something about a search engine on the air, and I got some Yahoo executive called and said, thanks for saying search engine and not saying Google. I mean, it's gotten to the point now where there are a lot of people who are saying maybe Google's become too powerful. What do you say to that?
Well, I think it's important to remember that Google is a user-driven phenomenon. We have great search, and one reason this brand has built into what it is because users really like the product and they use it. And the internet itself is a user-driven phenomenon. And so for us, that brand, our influence and our services are really driven by the overall usage, which is why we put the user first in all of our product evolution.
Talking, if you just joined us, with Marissa Meyer. She's Vice President of Search Product and User Experience for Google. I don't know if it's a credo or not, don't be evil. I think, in fact, you've pointed out it wasn't something ordained nor elected. It came from, somebody who shared an office space with you.
Yeah, it's a good story. My comments last week were basically just that someone said it was our official motto, and if anything, it was our unofficial motto. And there is a really good story behind it. When we were really small, we were mostly engineers, and some business people were hired, and they started taking meetings with clients. And I remember my cube mate, Amit, because we moved actually from a cube to an office later, became very concerned. I could just hear him stewing all day long. What do you think they're going to meet with those clients about? What do you think they're going to promise to those clients? Do you think they're going to make us, you know, sell our search results? Do you think they're going to make us build things that we don't think we should build? And Amit was really, really, really worked up about this. And then suddenly Amit disappeared for a little while, and then he came back to the cube, and he was very calm. And I didn't really understand what had happened, but I was busy coding, and then it turned out what he had done is he had gone and written, you know, on one of the whiteboards in his very neat handwriting in the lower right-hand corner, where he knew Joan, one of our lead sales executives, would see it, "Don't be evil," as a reminder to Joan in this meeting to remember that we needed to have unbiased search and to remember that, you know, what our core products and values really were. And so it became sort of the statement that we would all make to each other on and off. And then about 2 years into the company, our human resources group decided we should have core values. So they sat us down. They gathered a bunch of old timers and they sat us down in a room and made us, you know, come up with all these core values. Act like an owner, you know, hire smart people, these types of core values. And then another one of our office mates, Amit, Paul, and I all shared an office at the time. Paul Buchheit said, you know, why don't we just go with Amit's thing from back in the day? Don't be evil. And he's like, because that encompasses everything else that's out there.
Depending on how
the board
you define
right
evil,
now.
Of course. Yeah.
And so he said, you know, it's sort of all-encompassing. And I remember, actually, that the HR people tried to revise it because they said it was very negative for a core value to begin with, don't. So they changed it to do good, which we all, of course, railed back against. Paul made the point that, no, don't be evil is catchier. And so it's more mosaic, too.
It's like the Ten Commandments, you know, thou shalt not. Yeah.
And it is, I mean, it is sort of our unofficial motto because of those 10 core values, that's the one that everyone remembers because it's the catchiest.
Well, there's been, you know, questioning that I'm sure you've heard about Google being perhaps more concerned with shareholders or with, cooperating with government like China. More of that from Yahoo, of course, than from Google. But these kinds of things which suggest maybe they're not sticking to or as tenacious with those core values as they ought to be.
Well, I think that, you know, we have a very large business at this point, and it is, in fact, there's a large amount of responsibility that comes through it. And all those types of decisions, China, for example, are met with a lot of internal debate. And with the China debate, for example, we debated it for several years before opening our office there and entering the market. And what we basically found was that reasonable people disagree. There were two philosophies, engagement and estrangement.
But forgive me, it wasn't so much opening an office there, it was censoring and going along with the Chinese government that came under severe criticism, yes?
That's right. But in order to...
But you had your own internal process.
But in order
process,
to open an office, it meant making those decisions. And we basically came to the conclusion that in this particular case, engaging, actually being able to provide our search and some of our other information tools into China actually had a greater benefit for the Chinese people than deciding to estrange ourselves, and that's why we engaged. That said, we do keep a very close eye on exactly what we're being asked to do.
The corporate culture at Google, though, I wonder if you could reflect for a moment, when it comes to these core values and they're face-to-face with profit loss or shareholder loss, again, it's always an internal democratic process, one would presume, although there's power at the top. But how do you work through these? Give us a sense of the process, how they work through.
Well, we have a lot of rigorous debate and a lot of data. And we definitely do make choices that we think benefit the user, even if it means making less money. A classic example is right now we don't run ads on our image search property. That's not because we wouldn't like to. It's just that the ads that we have run there are text ads. It turns out we could probably make somewhere on the order of $80 million to $200 million in a given year if we did put those text ads on image search. But our metrics show us that people would actually start using image search less. Not a lot less, but about 1% less. And we looked at all that data. We had a rigorous debate around it. And we said, you know, would $80 million or $200 million worth of revenue on image search be worth trading off that usage? And we actually value the user and the usage so much that we said, no, even though it's a small, you know, a small decrement, we really think it indicates that users are less happy with the product. And we won't sacrifice the product in the eyes of the user just to make that incremental money.
Speaking about making incremental money, there was a report in economist.com and a number of places back when you hit the peak of getting all-time high in advertising in November that there was less clicking going on, that clicking seemed to be taking a dip. Where are you now? There was, I think April 17th, we were supposed to get some new figures, weren't we?
That's right. So yeah. We had our earnings call last week. And it's really, you know, the web is such a complicated ecosystem. So one of the interesting things that happens is we actually have found that if we can show less ads that are more relevant, we may actually get fewer clicks, but they may in fact be more meaningful clicks that convert more often to sales for our advertisers. And so we do a lot to optimize our advertisements to try and make them as relevant as the search results they appear alongside. So rather than showing an irrelevant advertisement or one that's potentially irrelevant, if we have an algorithmic way of trying to understand which ads will be the best, we'll actually elect to show fewer ads to make those ads more relevant to the user because we think that ultimately delivers a better experience for both the user and the advertiser.
And talking of you, joining us with Marissa Meyer, and she's Vice President, Global Vice President of Search Product and User Experience for Google, and we'll give you an opportunity to ask questions or make comments with her in just a moment. I saw your talk on innovation that you gave at Stanford, and I was struck by a couple of things. You seem to draw on your own experience going back to Wisconsin. I mean, there was somebody who was a piano teacher's daughter that you mentioned, for example.
Laura Beckman.
Talked about your art teacher mother. You know, I mean, you. And this is kind of Midwest core values, isn't it? You go back and you draw upon what you were inculcated, what was inculcated in you from your childhood, even your teenage years.
Yeah. Well, I think everyone builds on their own experience, and I really value my time in the Midwest. I really love Wisconsin, and I actually think that in terms of our product design and the way we evolve it is a very good lens and view to have, right? I go home at Christmas time and, you know, my friends will say, well, what are you doing? And I'll talk to them about all these different things. And I have one friend who's a sculptor who literally about 2 years ago looked at me and said, it's like we live on different planets. He sculpts with clay all day in a barn. And, you know, he was like, you know, we both really value what the other one does. But it was interesting to me just to see how little all the details of tech matter, right, to someone who just wants to use our products and get the most out of the internet. And I think that that's one thing that really helps coach me towards simplicity, right? All those details that computer scientists love or someone that's really enraptured with the technology might want to hear all about need to be just eclipsed by the interface. So if you're an expert user, you can go and find out those details. But if you're just someone who wants to get information, it's just simple and clean and easy. And the fact that there's thousands of computers behind the scenes making it all work doesn't matter.
Yeah, like I think you alluded at one point, my mother wouldn't get this. This would be too complicated for her. I mean, there's a sense of really wanting as core values to serve the user.
Well, my mom is a great example user because she's very smart, but she's a little afraid of technology. And so a lot of times when I look at a new interface and say a user interface review or a product review, I try and look at it through her eyes of, you know, if you know, would this intuitively make sense? Would I be willing to try this? You know, or would this be one of these types of details that I would just gloss over? And so we really do want to make sure that we're building products that serve a broad audience of users and do so really simply and really well.
You mentioned that your mother's a little technophobic. Are you... Do you like being called a geek, or do you recoil at it? I remember once somebody said that geek, somebody sent me an email and said that geek is one of those words that ought to be eliminated, like ethnic slur words or something like that. Really took umbrage at it.
I'm definitely a geek. And it's interesting because when people ask me, you know, what it's like to be at Google, it's great. It's a culture entirely of geeks. And a lot of people are motivated and interested in the same things that I'm interested in. By my nature, I'm actually a very shy person. One thing that I notice is when I'm at Google, I'm not very shy at all. And I think that's just because I feel very at home with the people around me, with what they're interested in, you know, what really gets them motivated. And in truth, we're all geeks. We all want to check out the latest gadget. We want to all see the latest technology evolving on the web. What's the latest site? Have you checked out this? Have you checked out that? And you know, I just love it. And you know, at one point I built a wall of LED lights in my apartment. And you know, I had opinions from engineers, product managers, lawyers from all over the building telling me what they knew about three-color addressable LED lights. Could they be bought in strings? How do you program them? What's the interface? How does the driver work? Right, all of those types of elements. And so I just love that. So yes, I'm a geek, and there's definitely a geek culture at Google that I think is really fun and really valuable.
There's also a culture. I went down there to give a talk and ate there, and I was struck by it's a culture of youth in many ways, and it's like being on a college campus, but there's so much that is taken care of for young people. Some say this is a way to keep them working all the time. I don't know if that's you may want to opine on that, but there's so many available services for the young people who work there. I mean, it's really quite extraordinary.
Well, I wouldn't call it a culture of youth as much as it's a culture of energy, right? There's just a real energy and vibrance on the campus. And it is true, I think, that as we sort of look at some of the new style workplaces, one thing that they do really well is blend elements of home and work and make it more comfortable and convenient for people to be at work. So we do have laundry machines where our engineers have worked out very complicated systems with timers that you take with you that remind you to go and switch from washing to drying.
These are things that come to your attention when you're in your office? Are these things about the laundry machines?
Well, I just think it's so great. It shows you more about that geek culture that, you know, they actually have engineered everything right down to the timing system on the laundry machines. And we have great food on the campus. And my favorite perk is actually shipping and receiving at work, because it means that, you know, I don't have a lot of time to shop, but I'll shop a lot online. I'll have things delivered right to work, go into the bathroom, try them on, and either ship them back or take them home. So, but we do have a lot of things that just make it a lot more convenient to be a career person that's busy but still getting things done.
We're talking to Marissa Meyer all about the culture of Google and about innovation and really about whatever questions and comments you might have. And you are certainly welcome to join us, and that is a cordial invitation, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. We welcome your questions or comments. Again, our toll-free number for your calls is 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to us, and our email address is simply forum@kqed.org. When we return, your calls and emails on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Marissa Meyer, who is Vice President of Search Product and User Experience for Google. And there was an article in Harper's a while ago that said that Google triggered the arms race with Microsoft, the whole infrastructure arms race, and with Yahoo as well. And I'd like to get some thoughts from you on that, as well as what your thoughts are about the possibility of Microsoft taking over Yahoo.
Well, I think on the infrastructure point, there was a basic insight in the early days of Google that when you look at what was happening with processing power, with storage, you know, disk space, it became clear that a basic PC that was sold a desktop to a consumer was going to have a lot of power. And as a result, it made sense to have lots of redundant computers as part of a network rather than the large mainframes that a lot of other companies were buying at the time. And I think that was an important insight, and it's one thing that has caused us to build up some of the server farms that we've built. Because by relying on those types of processors, we just are able to really use a lot more compute power, and also have a lot more flexibility and reliability in how we run our computing systems. I still remember actually going to the early data centers, and a lot of the other, what happens is you go into the data center and there's cages of computers, and every company runs a cage, and most cages just would have 5 or 6 really big boxes, and we would have refrigerators of, you know, 80 machines each, so hundreds and hundreds of machines, where you may remember eBay in June of 1999 had an outage where they were down for a day, and it was a worldwide event. And people in the data centers would point at this one big box in eBay's cage, and they would say, "That's it. That's the computer that took down eBay in June of 1999. And when you looked at the Google computers, you know, there's no way. I mean, yes, there might be a few, failure points there, but generally there's so many computers that there's not one computer that's really responsible for the functioning of the site or some part of the site. They all act in harmony, each being called on based on their current load, the functions they're currently able to pursue.
It's a synchronicity.
You know, is it ad serving? Is it index serving? Yeah. What are they doing? And because there's so many computers working, it basically means if one of them has a problem or has a failure, we can just call on another one. And it's a really flexible architecture.
What do you say, though, to the argument that the building of these data centers causes, too much energy guzzling?
Well, I think that's something that we've taken very seriously. And so we made our commitment to go green, and we try and run our data centers in a way that we offset the energy that we use. In fact, we've actually placed some of the data centers that we have close to alternative power sources. So some of them actually do draw some power from hydroelectricity or wind power.
I'm going to go to our callers in just a minute, but Gmail scans specific words in the content of emails and targets instantly targeted relevant ads, and some people feel this kind of creepy. What's your response to this?
Well, it's important to understand how the algorithm for Gmail works. It's a program. It takes the text of an email, and it doesn't really scan for words as much as it boils down to the essence. What are the important keywords in that message? And then it goes and gets ads for those keywords. So, you know, to look at, you know, several hundred words and come up with 5 to 10 that are really important, and then go and fetch those advertisements. And it works much in the way that a spam filter would or a spell check would. It's an automated program that scans through the content to try and help the user do something that's more relevant, be it spell checking, spam filtering, ad serving, and tries to get content that would be more relevant than, say, a banner ad.
Let me go to our callers, and we begin, Arthur, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm a board member of the Girls Middle School in Mountain View, and we thank you for hosting our entrepreneurial night for the last several years. I understand that the Google has this idea that having more women in technology is important for creativity in the workplace. I'd like to talk about the pipeline, the women and computer science pipeline, and how you think you can help that process, and whether you do think it helps in terms of creativity.
Well, I do think that it's very important to have a good balance of technical women in a software company. And interestingly, I was Google's first woman engineer, and when I was hired, there were 8 engineers. And I remember giving Larry and Sergey a very hard time trying to understand how they'd gotten as large as 8 without hiring any women. And they assured me that they actually felt it was very important to have a healthy size group of women involved in a technical capacity in the company. They had read a lot of research around how to form the best companies, and and a lot of studies show that if you fall below, say, 20% of the workforce being women, things become really imbalanced and unhealthy inside the corporate culture. So they were very focused on having about 25% of our technical workforce be women. And we really achieved that. We've worked very hard at that. in terms of our hiring. And we also
What about on the technical side?
That's the technical side. That is the technical side. Okay. And we actually work a lot with universities to try and encourage women to pursue computer science. So we've done a lot with Grace Hopper. We actually issue fellowships and scholarships to women working in computer science who have shown outstanding academic records to try and reward and facilitate more people entering software engineering and computer science as an academic pursuit.
And Arthur, we thank you for the call. We're going to go right to more calls. Here we go to Janice next. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Ms. Meyer, where you describe what Google is looking for is as energy rather than youth, I think it's a proven fact that there are no older people, even highly qualified people, working at Google, and you do not even let people come in for an interview. I mean, it doesn't strike me as fair, especially in light of what you said about trying to encourage more women to apply. There is a vast segment of older Americans who now have to work a lot more years than they used to. And it would be nice if Google would consider their qualifications when they're applying for jobs.
And we do. We actually have all age groups represented at Google, from very young to very old. And we very much look at the qualifications of each candidate. So there are, for example, no policies as referenced around older people not being allowed to come in for interviews. We assess each candidate on their own merits.
And I thank Janice for her call. Go right to another caller in Oakland. Sky, good morning.
Hi, Marissa. I want to thank you so much for all of the innovation that Google has produced. It's just been tremendous. One of the things that was mentioned at the beginning of the program is that Google has been working on natural language interfaces for wireless devices and desktop computers for search. This is an extremely exciting potential innovation and, you know, can enable wireless devices to become personal valets in a way that we've never seen before. I'm just really curious, how close are we to such devices, if you could just kind of project into the future, or how close are we to that kind of technology?
Sure. Well, what we have available right now is something called 1-800-GOOG-411, which you can actually dial on your cell phone, and it's a free 411 service. So unlike your cellular provider, it won't charge you $1 or $1.25 per call. And you can actually talk to GOOG-411, and it will do a search and read you and or SMS you back your search results. And what we're doing there is, one, trying to understand where we are and with our state-of-the-art in terms of search, but two, the other thing that happens is each time you call, we get new voice samples to train off of. And using those voice samples, we actually can do a better job building out more sophisticated natural language in the future because it's actually a self-training algorithm.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Sky.
Yeah.
I just wanted to address it a little bit more. So basically what you're doing, you're kind of in the training phase for your AI to try to get it to recognize natural language from lots and lots of different voice signatures.
That's right. And so we find that about 80% of the calls that come to GOOG-411 actually are met with satisfaction on the part of the user. They get the information that they're looking for. And so we like where we are right now, but that said, there's still a long way yet to go. And I actually think that the fact that the service is growing and is being used more actually is great because it means that the service will get better. So you can see where we are in terms of our state of the art at GOOG-411, but it will ultimately improve quickly.
And thank you, Sky. Do you know that you say about? You almost sound Canadian. Anybody call that? Curious. Let me go to some emails before I go to some more calls. Jane writes, what do you think about improving the relevancy of search results by using controlled vocabulary such as medicine, National Library of Medicine does? For example, the medical subject index is a great place to start a search and obtain the correct term for a search. Do you foresee any structure like that coming to Google, something simply presented to the average user that would facilitate accurate searching?
Sure. I think it's a valid and interesting question. It's a debate that we consistently have. That said, I don't believe, given the breadth of our user base, that we can expect our users to learn syntax, learn things like a correct term. It's interesting. One of the things I studied in my undergraduate major is linguistics. And in linguistics...
At Stanford. With Seth Lehrer?
I did it with Tom Wasow.
Oh, okay.
And in the syntax class, we actually would do... Over the course of the quarter, we developed both a descriptive grammar of English and a prescriptive grammar of English. Mm-hmm. How are people supposed to talk versus how do they actually talk? Mm-hmm. and they're completely different. It was really fascinating to look at the two trees. And I really think that given Google's pervasiveness, given the broad international usage that we have, we really can't be in a state where we are expecting users to know special keywords or to know special syntaxes. We just have to let them express what they want to express, how they want to express it in the search box, and pick it up from there and compensate from any of the shortcomings in our system around that.
Before I go to more calls, I want to go to some more emails. Here's Rachel who says, I think Google's a great company that comes out with a lot of wonderful products. As an architect, I use Google SketchUp a lot and find it very useful. However, I think it could be improved in some ways. I suggest that Google consult with people in the architectural field to improve the product and make it a competitive modeling program. But I'll bet you do, don't you?
That's right. We do. We get user feedback. We also do a lot of focus groups and user studies with our tools to try and understand what are the features that are missing, what features should we be adding next. And SketchUp is an amazing tool. When we look at what it's doing in terms of three-dimensional layers in Google Earth, some of the cities that in the world that are being modeled are just incredibly detailed and just beautiful models to look at. So I think we are constantly working. It's the launch early and iterate philosophy, launch early and often, where we're taking, for example, SketchUp and constantly changing it, adding new features, doing new shipments and builds. So the product changes every few weeks, every month or so, always coming out with new features. So our goal is to get as close as possible to meeting those user needs, even for professional users.
Is there something you'd love to do that seems like pie in the sky, just seems almost unreachable at this point of technology?
In terms of what?
Mm-hmm. Just in terms of user searching and what can be available to users. Is there, in other words, some kind of concept that just seems at this point like maybe almost futuristic, utopian?
Well, I think that, one, just there's comprehensiveness, right, getting all of the information. But when we look at the future of search, I really think it's about modes. Can it be in phones? Can it be in cars? Can you get to it anywhere? Media. Does it come in the form of pictures, videos? Sometimes a video is a great answer for how to tie a bow tie. Pictures and video are a much better answer than any text anyone can write. And then also looking at the presentation around that media. And then, of course, there's personalization. Having the search engine understand a little bit more about you and be able to tailor your results, knowing what you already know, knowing what you might prefer. Those are the types of things that I think are really where search is going to go over the next decade or two. And I really think that in the end, the search engine should be able to answer your questions as well as a person could or an expert on the topic.
Well, you can, as the expert here this morning, you can answer a few more questions that have come to us via email. In fact, let me go through a few more emails. Actually, this is just a statement that it sounds like an ad for Google, Google Earth. Brandon says, I love Google Earth. It gives me a way to fly around the world and just explore things in a way I always dreamed of. I can go where I want to visit, go to where I used to live, or learn about places in a whole new way. Now, here's Mike, who says, I find Google provides too much provided information, phone number, address, et cetera, when just first and last name of a person is searched. I like to have the option to be removed from search results. Can be, though, right?
Yeah, we do have a tool for you to remove your phone number or any other personal information from search results.
Here's a listener, Roxanne, who says, how'd you feel about the article on you recently in San Francisco Magazine, which touted you not only as an incredibly savvy businesswoman, but also as some sort of glamazon socialite?
I think with all articles like that, there are both good parts and bad parts of it. I think that on the whole, there were definitely parts that I liked. I think that there were also some parts that probably were out of focus or out of balance with how much of a role they actually play in my overall life.
But I know Julian Guthrie's worked for many years, and she's a good journalist.
She's a very good journalist. But I do think that because she saw more of the social side, that dominated in the article, where the business side is really what occupies a lot more of my time.
You're still in the cupcake business?
I've never been in the cupcake business. There is a bakery, a really talented baker who actually sculpts cakes, who I've been a friend with and a supporter of. So it's called I Dream of Cake, and it's a great cake shop. So I'm still in that business. And with cupcakes, I just like to bake them. I like to analyze recipes. I'm constantly doing iterations of my own recipe. And so I just like to cook and like to bake, and it's something that's fun for me.
Midwest girl in you. Yeah, former pom-pom girl, in fact, as well as ballet. student for many years. We learned from that Julian Guthrie article. Here's Charles in Berkeley, who wants to know about Google's plans in terms of news, simply to continue aggregating from other sources or doing original reporting. And you might want to also talk about, well, what many are seeing is the demise of newspapers. Where's content going to come from?
Sure. So with Google News, we've always been very clear and firm that we're computer scientists. And what we ultimately bring to Google News as a tool is algorithms that help people understand the news, cluster it. We can actually take a broad array of news and cluster it based on topics. So you can see all the stories reporting on the same event and all the different viewpoints reflected from all around the world. And I think that's one thing that news really really does well. That said, we aren't journalists, we aren't editors, we aren't making editorial decisions. Instead, we're harnessing the power of editors all around the world. What did they put on the front page of their overall website? What did they put on the front page of their entertainment section? And using those placements and those editorial judgments from all those newspapers, we're analyzing them in aggregate and saying, okay, this must be the most important story, let's put this on top. This must be the most important story in entertainment, let's lead with that. All done algorithmically. In fact, when we first launched the product, we actually had a disclaimer on the bottom of the page that said, this page was generated entirely by a computer algorithm. No humans were harmed or even used in the creation of this page, and that still remains true today.
Is there a danger, though, in, for example, the more hits, the more that story is going to be covered, or the more that story will be a lead story?
There's some element of that. And so we have looked at how can we introduce serendipity into the algorithm to try and promote lesser covered stories or viewpoints that might be seen less. So we've taken
serendipity into the algorithm. I love that.
But on the whole, I really do think it's providing a valuable service. And it's important to recognize that Google News actually helps reinforce some of the journalism that's happening because it drives traffic to those original websites and sometimes surfaces stories that you wouldn't otherwise find. I've talked to so many people who've said, you know, I really discovered that I liked the way that the BBC covers the Middle East, or I saw this really interesting viewpoint in the Sacramento Bee. People discover new news sources through Google News, and it actually drives a lot of traffic to online newspapers.
Talking to Marissa Meyer and Jason from Sacramento. Join us. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering if you guys could talk about all the speculation around the Google phone and Android. And I was wondering, is it just speculation or is there actually going to be a product somewhere down the road?
Well, there is a product and it does exist. It was announced last November, which is an operating system for a phone that's been made available to developers. So what we've done is we've created a small operating system that can run on the phone, and that was released to developers because that way developers starting already last November could begin to write applications for the phone. So the Android OS could ultimately become as rich and as powerful as some of the operating systems you already see on phones. And so we wanted it to be open source. We wanted people to be able to participate in it because we ultimately think that causes technology to evolve and innovate faster and provides better functionality to the end user. So that's the Android phone.
And thank you, Jason, for that call. We're going to go to Wetumpka, Alabama. Bill, join us.
Yeah.
Where's Wetumpka, Alabama, by the way?
Yes. Wetumpka, Alabama is just 12 miles northeast of Montgomery, Alabama.
Okay. Now I got you. Okay. We were looking at the Google map in our heads. Yeah, go ahead.
Does our guest foresee a time in the future when all academic papers and premium content will be fully available through Google, perhaps through a tiered membership program?
We would love that. Today we have something called Google Scholar that puts journals and scholarly articles online and makes them searchable. We're constantly reaching out to new sources to be included in Google Scholar and working with premium content sources to understand, especially now using facilities like Google Checkout, how we can facilitate online payments per article to meet some of the business needs of those premium sources.
And thank you, Bill. I'm going to go to some more of our emails here. A lot of questions for you. This is Michael who says, what percentage of work does Google outsource to India and China? And do you support education programs for low-income students in middle and high school? And in response to the previous caller, it's obviously illegal to discriminate on the basis of age. So, of course, there are no company policies that discriminate based on age. So what is the age demographic at Google? Three questions in one from Michael. First, how much do you a lot of outsourcing, don't you?
We actually do only a small amount of outsourcing. We do have offices in Beijing and Shanghai and Bangalore, India and Hyderabad, but those engineers are employees of Google. We do a small amount of outsourcing for things like testing, some elements of design or interface design will occasionally be outsourced. But generally, we try and bring the best engineers and their ideas and their energy into Google.
And you do a lot of support of low-income student programs, middle and high school?
One of the charges of the Google Foundation, Google.org, is education. And we believe really profoundly in education and supporting it. So we have done a fair amount of grants, usually at the university level, and scholarships to try and facilitate more technology education, more awareness, and trying
to build
teach? Innovation. I teach from time to time. I used to teach full courses where I would go and be the primary lecturer. Now occasionally I get to go back and do guest lectures. But it's something I do really miss because I loved doing that.
You've also got the same listener, asking about, well, the general age demographic. Can we get a fix on what the rough median is? Or?
Sure.
I don't have the
complete demographic information. That said, I know that we have some people who are as young as 20 that are employed. We have some people, I believe we have an employee who's about 70 or just maybe over that. And that said, we've had an interesting phenomenon over time that the median and mean age of the company generally follows the average of Larry and Sergey's age, which at this point is about 34 and a half or 35.
A few more questions from listeners via email. Here's Bill, who says, what are some of the ways you inspire a zealousness for product simplicity in your engineers and designers?
Well, I think that when you can make a product more simple, more people use it. And so a lot of our engineers are actually really fired up about having products that everyone can use or more users will use. And so they definitely, you know, it's not something that needs to necessarily even be inspired by zeal. I think it's the desire, the zeal comes from wanting it to reach a broad audience and having as many users as possible. And one of the best ways to achieve that is to make the product simple and straightforward to use.
Again, that's the ethos of the user and simplicity for the user. And here's Bruce, who says, can you tell us about the Google airplane? What does it look like inside? Where does it go and who gets to fly in it?
Unfortunately, I can't describe the inside of the airplane to you. It's obviously owned by Larry and Sergey, not even by Google, and so it's private for them. That said, we occasionally will use it for work trips, and so I've flown on it once or twice, and
comfortable?
It's comfortable.
That's all you need to know, the caller. Ed says, do you see in the near future actual healthcare paths, such as diagnosis and treatment, moving to the web, and if so, what role would Google Health play?
Google Health is something that's very exciting. It's a project that I'm working on very intensely at the moment. And I think the goal here is really to put the user more in control of their information. Right now, I'm a reasonably healthy person, but even finding out something like, am I overdue for my tetanus shot? Or do I need to be vaccinated for something before I go to India in June? Those are complicated questions. If I had access to my health records in digital form online, I could just look this up. But right now it's calls to 3 or 4 medical institutions, right? My hometown institution, Stanford, Palo Alto Medical Foundation, Stanford Hospital, to try and understand what vaccinations I've had with what periodicity. And that's a reasonably simple question. For people who have more complicated health problems, we really do think that they should be able to have their information digitized, so it can be preserved, so it's not subject to destruction, and something that they can control. We're doing a pilot right now with Cleveland Clinic, and there's really interesting findings that I didn't even anticipate, which, for example, it turns out that a large population in Cleveland summers in Cleveland and then will winter in either Arizona or Florida. And because a lot of those are more elderly patients, they will see doctors in both locations. And they used to actually have to carry physical records back and forth or carry their notes of what the doctor said in each place back to the other doctor. And now what they would do through Google Health is just give each of those facilities permission to upload their health information and then share the information back down. So it can be transported from one institution to the other in complete digital fidelity.
What about firewalls? What about protection for those records?
So obviously the security around Google Health is as strong as we can possibly make it. With those types of sharing facilities, the user decides. So you go and you say, I you know, this is my medical institution and I want to share information with them. So you actually set up the sharing links manually on the system so you understand exactly what information is coming in and what information is going out.
And we'll bring some more of our callers in. Bob, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I've been a loyal Google supporter customer for ages because of your stance on open source and creating a level platform and your support and your development of different open source platforms for cell phones and just everything that you seem to be doing. Do you plan on doing any direct competition with the Windows operating system or somehow directly promoting a development of like Red Hat desktops, things like that on the desktop platform?
Well, first of all, thank you for the kudos. We always like to hear from Google fans. And I do think our open source stance has been one that really has benefited us and the innovation that happens at Google. That said, we don't have any plans to build an operating system.
Let me thank Bob for the call. We're talking again, if you just joined us, with Marissa Meyer. She's Vice President of Search Product and User Experience at Google. And what are we going to look for next with Google as we come to the end of this hour? What should people be looking for, Google fans or even Google detractors for that matter?
Well, there's all kinds of exciting things that I think are about to happen at Google. Google Health, as I said, we're in pilot phase right now. I think that we will be seeing the public version of Google Health available shortly. I also think that things like books are something I'm really excited about. We're bringing more and more books online, and the Google Books product keeps getting better and better in terms of what you can find.
You're going to digitalize the whole library of the world at one. I mean, isn't that the plan?
We definitely want to get all published information online and searchable. And so obviously we have to do that within the bounds of copyright. And we've started with some of the books that are already out of copyright. But we've also been working with publishers to get some of the newer books. And in aggregate, we now have more than a million books online available through Google Books. And the search is pretty good. It's interesting. When I do a search on Google Books, based on those million books, each about 300 pages on average, it's about as good as our index was in 2000. So, and it's great information. It's got great publication quality. It's been fact-checked. It's really well-written. It's reliable information. And so Google Books is a really great asset, and I think there's a lot of exciting things happening there. And then in our core search products, I just think that there's going to be a lot of innovation. We came out with Universal Search last year that really helped blend things like pictures, videos, images, books, and local information all into the search result page, and I think that was great. And I also am really excited about things like iGoogle, which leads into search but allows people to get information on their homepage.
A lot of exciting things up ahead. Good luck to you. Continued success. Thank you. Marissa Meyer, again, VP Search Product and User Experience at Google. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.